Youth, by Joseph Conrad. But the dwarf answered, "No, something human is dearer to me than the wealth of all the world. Grimm's Tales. To my wife." Contents, Youth. A narrative. Youth, this could have occurred nowhere but in England, where men and sea interpenetrate, so to speak, the sea entering into the life of most men, and the men knowing something or everything about the sea, in the way of amusement, of travel, or of bread-winning. We were sitting round a mahogany table that reflected the bottle, the claret glasses, and our faces as we leaned on our elbows. There was a director of companies, an accountant, a lawyer, Marlowe, and myself. The director had been a Conway boy, the accountant had served 4 years at sea, the lawyer a fine-crusted Tory, high churchman, the best of old fellows, the soul of honor had been chief officer in the P&O service in the good old days, when mail boats were square-rigged at least on two masts, and used to come down the China Sea before a fair monsoon with stunned sails set alow and aloft. We all began life in the merchant service. Between the five of us there was the strong bond of the sea, and also the fellowship of the craft, which no amount of enthusiasm for yachting, cruising, and so on can give, since one is only the amusement of life, and the other is life itself. Marlowe, at least I think that is how he spelt his name, told the story, or rather the chronicle, of a voyage. Yes, I have seen a little of the Eastern Seas. But what I remember best is my first voyage there. You fellows know there are those voyages that seem ordered for the illustration of life, that might stand for a symbol of existence. You fight, work, sweat, nearly kill yourself, sometimes do kill yourself, trying to accomplish something and you can't. Not from any fault of yours. You simply can do nothing, neither great nor little, not a thing in the world, not even marry an old maid, or get a wretched 600-ton cargo of coal to its port of destination. It was altogether a memorable affair. It was my first voyage to the East, and my first voyage as second mate. It was also my skipper's first command. You'll admit it was time. He was 60 if a day, a little man, with a broad, not very straight back, with bowed shoulders and one leg more bandy than the other. He had that queer twisted about appearance you see so often in men who work in the fields. He had a nutcracker face, chin and nose trying to come together over a sunken mouth, and it was framed in iron gray fluffy hair that looked like a chin strap of cotton wool sprinkled with coal dust. And he had blue eyes in that old face of his, which were amazingly like a boy's, with that candid expression some quite common men preserve to the end of their days by a rare internal gift of simplicity of heart and rectitude of soul. What induced him to accept me was a wonder. I had come out of a crack Australian clipper, where I had been third officer, and he seemed to have a prejudice against crack clippers as aristocratic and high-toned. He said to me, "You know, in this ship you will have to work." ..." I said I had to work in every ship I had ever been in. "Ah, but this is different, and you gentlemen out of them big ships. But there. I dare say you will do. Join tomorrow." I joined tomorrow. It was 22 years ago, and I was just 20. How time passes. It was one of the happiest days of my life. Fancy. Second mate for the first time, a really responsible officer. I wouldn't have thrown up my new billet for a fortune. The mate looked me over carefully. He was also an old chap, but of another stamp. He had a Roman nose, a snow-white, long beard, and his name was Man, but he insisted that it should be pronounced Man. He was well-connected. Yet there was something wrong with his luck, and he had never got on. As to the captain, he had been 4 years in coasters, then in the Mediterranean, and last in the West Indian trade. He had never been round the Capes. He could just write a kind of sketchy hand, and didn't care for writing at all. Both were thorough good seamen, of course, And between those two old chaps I felt like a small boy between two grandfathers. The ship also was old. Her name was the Julia. Queer name, isn't it? She belonged to a man Wilmer Wilcox, some name like that. But he has been bankrupt, and dead these 20 years or more, and his name don't matter. As he had been laid up in Shadwell Basin forever so long. You can imagine her state. She was all rust, dust, grime soot aloft, dirt on deck. To me it was like coming out of a palace into a ruined cottage. She was about 400 tons, had a primitive windlass, wooden latches to the doors, not a bit of brass about her, and a big square stern. There was on it, below her name in big letters, a lot of scroll work, with the gilt off, and some sort of a coat of arms, with the motto, Do or Die underneath. I remember it took my fancy immensely. There was a touch of romance in it, something that made me love the old thing, something that appealed to my youth. We left London in ballast sand ballast to load a cargo of coal in a northern port for Bangkok. Bangkok. I thrilled. I had been 6 years at sea, but had only seen Melbourne and Sydney, very good places, charming places in their way, but Bangkok. We worked out of the Thames under canvas, with a North Sea pilot on board. His name was German, and he dodged all day long about the galley drying his handkerchief before the stove. Apparently he never slept. He was a dismal man, with a perpetual tear sparkling at the end of his nose, who either had been in trouble, or was in trouble, or expected to be in trouble, couldn't be happy, unless something went wrong. He mistrusted my youth, my common sense, and my seamanship, and made a point of showing it in a hundred little ways. I dare say he was right. It seems to me, I knew very little then, and I know not much more now, but I cherish a hate for that German to this day. We were a week working up as far as Yarmouth Roads, and then we got into a gale, the famous October gale of 22 years ago. It was wind, lightning, sleet, snow, and a terrific sea. We were flying light, and you may imagine how bad it was when I tell you we had smashed bulwarks and a flooded deck. On the second night she shifted her ballast into the lee bow, and by that time we had been blown off somewhere on the Dogger Bank. There was nothing for it, but go below with shovels and try to right her, and there we were in that vast hold, gloomy like a cavern, the tallow dips stuck and flickering on the beams, the gale howling above, the ship tossing about like mad on her side. There we all were, German, the captain, everyone, hardly able to keep our feet, engaged on that gravediggers work, and trying to toss shovelfuls of wet sand up to windward. At every tumble of the ship you could see vaguely in the dim light men falling down with a great flourish of shovels. One of the ship's boys we had too, impressed by the weirdness of the scene, wept as if his heart would break. We could hear him blubbering somewhere in the shadows. On the third day the gale died out, and by a North Country tug picked us up. We took 16 days in all to get from London to the Tyne. When we got into dock we had lost our turn for loading, and they hauled us off to a tier, where we remained for a month. Mrs. Beard, the captain's name was Beard, came from Colchester, to see the old man. She lived on board. The crew of runners had left, and there remained only the officers, one boy, and the steward, a mulatto who answered to the name of Abraham. Mrs. Beard was an old woman, with a face all wrinkled, and ruddy like a winter apple, and the figure of a young girl. She caught sight of me once, sewing on a button, and insisted on having my shirts to repair. This was something different from the captain's wives I had known on board crack clippers. When I brought her the shirts, she said, "And the socks? They want mending, I am sure, and John's Captain Beard's things are all in order now. I would be glad of something to do." Apostrophe, apostrophe, bless the old woman. She overhauled my outfit for me, and meantime I read for the first time Sartori Sardis's and Burnaby's Ride to Khiva. Apostrophe, apostrophe, I didn't understand much of the first then, but I remember I preferred the soldier to the philosopher at the time, a preference which life has only confirmed. One was a man, and the other was either more or less. However, they are both dead, and Mrs. Beard is dead, a youth, strength, genius, thoughts, achievements, simple hearts all die. No matter. They loaded us at last. We shipped a crew. 8 able seamen and 2 boys. We hauled off one evening to the buoys at the dock gates, ready to go out, and with a fair prospect of beginning the voyage next day. Mrs. Beard was to start for home by a late train. When the ship was fast we went to tea. We sat rather silent through the meal, man, the old couple, and one. I finished first, and slipped away for a smoke, my cabin being in a deck house just against the poop. It was high water, blowing fresh with a drizzle, the double dock gates were opened, and the steam colliers were going in, and out in the darkness with their lights burning bright, a great plashing of propellers, rattling of winches, and a lot of hailing on the pier heads. I watched the procession of headlights gliding high, and of green lights gliding low in the night, when suddenly a red gleam flashed at me, vanished, came into view again, and remained. The fore end of a steamer loomed up close. I shouted down the cabin, "Come up, quick!" ... and then heard a startled voice saying afar in the dark, "Stop her, sir!" ... a bell jingled. Another voice cried warningly, "We are going right into that bark, sir." ... The answer to this was a gruff "all right." ... And the next thing was a heavy crash as the steamer struck a glancing blow with the bluff of her bow about our fore rigging. There was a moment of confusion, yelling, and running about. Steam roared. Then somebody was heard saying, "All clear, sir." ... Are you all right? ... asked the gruff voice. I had jumped forward to see the damage, and hailed back, "I think so." ... easy astern, said the gruff voice. A bell jingled. "What steamer is that?" ... screamed man. By that time she was no more to us than a bulky shadow maneuvering a little way off. They shouted at us some name, a woman's name, Miranda or Melissa or some such thing. "This means another month in this beastly hole," ... said man to me, as we peered with lamps about the splintered bulwarks and broken braces. "But where's the captain?" ... We had not heard or seen anything of him all that time. We went aft to look. A doleful voice arose hailing somewhere in the middle of the dock, "Judy ahoy!" ... How the devil did he get there? Hello! ... We shouted. "I am adrift in our boat without oars," ... he cried. A belated waterman offered his services, and man struck a bargain with him for half a crown, to tow our skipper alongside. But it was Mrs. Beard that came up the ladder first. They had been floating about the dock in that miserly cold rain for nearly an hour. I was never so surprised in my life. It appears that when he heard my shout "come up," ... he understood at once what was the matter, caught up his wife, ran on deck, and across, and down into our boat, which was fast to the ladder. Not bad for a 60-year-old. Just imagine that old fellow saving heroically in his arms, that old woman, the woman of his life. He set her down on a thwart, and was ready to climb back on board, when the painter came adrift somehow, and away they went together. Of course in the confusion we did not hear him shouting. He looked abashed. She said cheerfully, "I suppose it does not matter my losing the train now?" ... No, Jenny, you go below and get warm, ... he growled. Then to us, "A sailor has no business with a wife, I say." There I was, out of the ship. Well, no harm done this time. Let's go and look at what that fool of a steamer smashed. ... It wasn't much, but it delayed us 3 weeks. At the end of that time, the captain being engaged with his agents, I carried Mrs. Beard's bag to the railway station, and put her all comfy into a third-class carriage. She lowered the window to say, "You are a good young man. If you see John Captain Beard without his muffler at night, just remind him from me to keep his throat well wrapped up." Apostrophe, apostrophe, certainly, Mrs. Beard, apostrophe, I said. "You are a good young man. I noticed how attentive you are to John," to Captain apostrophe. The train pulled out suddenly. I took my cap off to the old woman. I never saw her again. ... Pass the bottle. We went to sea next day. When we made that start for Bangkok, we had been already 3 months out of London. We had expected to be a fortnight or so at the outside. It was January, and the weather was beautiful, the beautiful sunny winter weather that has more charm than in the summertime, because it is unexpected, and crisp, and you know it won't, it can't, last long. It's like a windfall, like a godsend, like an unexpected piece of luck. It lasted all down the North Sea, all down Channel, and it lasted till we were 300 miles or so to the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.